my employer doesn't know I do YouTube stuff. So I've up till this point, this is probably it's probably a tipping point now. Your podcast.
This is the moment, John. This is the moment.
This is the moment. On the way to the test centre, my speedo cable broke on the bike. So I had no speedo. And I thought, when I got there, I was like, oh, do I tell the examiner I've got no speedo? Because he may say, sorry, you can't do it. Or do I just guess the speed limits? And that's what I did. So I guessed the speed limits. So when I finished it, I thought, I'm never going to pass. You know, I'm going to open a bit of speeding. So congratulations, you passed. I was like, do I tell him now?
That's amazing.
Probably the dream bike is the Honda RCV MotoGP bike, the road trim. That is probably the dream machine. I would love to ride on the road.
Hello there and welcome to Full Chat with me, David Prutton.
And me, Ewan Thomas, celebrating all things we love about being on two wheels. Full Chat is powered by Bikesure. As the UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker, Bikesure will tailor a quote to your exact needs, helping you save money on your annual bike, scooter or moped insurance.
Don't forget to press subscribe on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or you can press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from.
Right, today's guest is a gentleman I'm sure many of you will be well aware of, given the fact he's one of the biggest bike YouTubers there is in the country with close to 150,000 subscribers on YouTube, and his videos have already had well over 50 million views today. His real name is John Bennett, but you will know him as Lamb Chop Rides. Welcome, John.
Hello, guys. Great to be on. Great. Big fan, I have to say. I've been watching a lot of the podcasts and really, really good. So,
fantastic.
It sounds
job.
Quite impressive when you said under 50,000 subscribers, 12 million views. I'm like, bloody hell, they talk. I can't be me, surely.
It's impressive.
You've been very magnanimous there, John. And I think we'll get onto the figures. We're going to get a deep dive into where it comes from and what you do and how much we really, really enjoy it, mate. It's such a pleasure to have Mr. Lamb Chop on with us. But let's go back to the start. Where you are now, we'll get to that in due course. But at the beginning, the love of bikes, it's in our bones, it's in our blood. Where does it start? Where does it come from for you?
Oh, that's a really good question. Now, my dad was well into bikes. He did a lot of scrambling in his youth. And when I was a kid, he always had a bike in the garage. And then my uncle was into a lot of racing. So he was well into his bikes. He did a lot in the 60s and 70s. He competed and he was actually really good. So he was sort of racing against Barrachine. And then he had a big accident, done his leg in basically. And that was the end of his racing career. But he was actually pretty quick. So I've sort of always grown up with him popping around on his latest bikes. And, so there's always been that. And then, of course, back in the early 90s, late 80s, when I, probably not a bit further back now, probably early 80s, when you were 16, everyone, of course, jumped on 50cc mopeds back then. You know, it was the done thing. So there was probably about 20 people in my year who jumped onto little mopeds, little DT50s. So there's this little community of bikers, and it basically just stayed. Those mates I made then, you know, I still see a lot of those guys, and it just sort of all grew from there, really. So it was all, you know, went up through the progression, sort of the 125s, then onto the sort of 252 strokes, and sort of carried on like that. And then, it's always been in the blood from the parents. And then I say it's just getting on bikes and kids. And it's just fantastic, isn't it? It's one of those things that it's the community. Yeah, it brings people together, but it's also that massive sort of community side of it. And I think a lot of, well, I'd say all of my friends now, are bikers, you know. I don't have many friends who aren't bikers now. You know, I've sort of stuck with those people really through the years.
Proper people, that's what it is, John.
Yeah, exactly.
It's nice though, isn't it, perhaps, when we speak to people like yourself, John, who have been inspired by, be it the uncle or the dad, and, you know,
There's always an uncle.
It's passed down from generations, and then your social network have become bikers and they've remained bikers. And, you know, I absolutely love it. Yeah. Did you ever have that in mind? Let's talk about when you set the channel up. I think it was 2012. So you were one of the first biking podcasts and YouTubers who've done so well. Did you ever think back then? I'm assuming that YouTube wasn't around when you were first biking, but do you have to pinch yourself sometimes to think how successful your YouTube channel is?
Absolutely. Even though I think I've been in 14, 15 years. It's probably, I always say 14 years, but it's probably a few more years than that now. But yeah, I've been doing it a long time, and you know, I was inspired to get into the YouTube side of things. People like Band Von Grumble, I know you had on, you know, a few weeks ago, Chris. which is he's quite a good friend of mine as well now, which is quite weird. The people you sort of aspired to back then, you're sort of mates with now, you know. So that's always a little bit strange as well. But I was sort of inspired by him, and I had a break from motorcycling. So when the kids were born, the missus was like, you know, it's dangerous, these bikes, you know. And I was like, well, yeah, I sort of agree. So I had probably a 10-year period in my life where I didn't have bikes. And I was sort of almost forgot about bikes a little bit. I don't know how it's possible now, but my brother-in-law, Greg, he's always had bikes for his whole life. And he was one of the people who I met at school, you know, one of this group of people I spoke about at the beginning. Mm-hmm. But every year he'd be like, oh, you've got to get another bike. But we were pretty skinny, we didn't have much money. So it was a financial thing as well.
Yeah.
But when the kids sort of left school, I sort of said to the missus, I said, you know what? I sort of got into fast forwards and had a few Cosworths and stuff like that.
Oh, nice.
We were really skinned. And it had a nice three-door Sierra Cosworth, like Moonstone, and the engine blew up on it. And I just couldn't really afford to repair the thing. So I ended up selling it as a rolling chassis. And but my missus come back when I was on the drive sort of stripping bits off it. To sort of, it's just my pride and joy. And she came back and thought, she said to me, you can get a bike. You know, go and get yourself a bike, you know. And I said, oh, I'm not bothered, you know. And then, but then I thought, you know, I wouldn't mind another bike, actually. Mm. But because I've been out of it, you know, there's that period where I wasn't even sort of following biking. There's a lot of new models coming out. I just wasn't aware of. I was completely disconnected from it. And as I say, my brother-in-law was sort of always nagging and saying, you've got to get one. And then I decided to buy a CBR 900 Fireblade. Mm-hmm. I think it cost me a couple of grand. And the biggest bike I've ridden before that was an XR 750, and it's sort of generations apart, you know. So yeah. I picked up this bike. And the way it all started is over the winter, I started doing some tinkering to it, and I was on a lot of forums at the time, like Fireblade forums and that sort of stuff. And I'd sort of keep track of a bit of restoration work I was doing on this bike. And I ended up sort of stripping it all down and putting 1,000 engine in it. And I thought, I've got to document this in some way. So I just had a GoPro and I was just doing all this. It's still on the channel now. It's one of the first videos I've done. There's about 26 episodes of this Fireblade sort of restoration stroke upgrade. And that sort of started to catch off. And I'm quite creative. I did sort of art A level, and I did drama for A level as well. So I've always been sort of a bit creative, and I really enjoyed the whole editing process of doing those videos. So when it was all done, and like I say, Chris Eads had started doing his Band Von Grumble thing. I thought, you know what? For the test ride, I'll rig up a microphone on my helmet and we'll sort of just talk through the test ride in the bike. And I really liked it. People seemed to like it and watch it. And I thought, and it all sort of grew from there, really. So it was sort of quite organic. I didn't start it wanting to do or be on YouTube, but it was a different sort of format to sort of rather than posting up pictures on forums to actually put it onto YouTube. And yeah, it sort of went from there, really.
So what then, because there is a moment, and having the pleasure of speaking to people like yourself, John, where there seemingly does come a moment when you're doing this, when you suddenly, the realisation goes, well, actually, this can now be the thing that I do. So what was the thing that you did before this? Yeah. And what was the tipping point where suddenly it was jump off at the deep end?
Well, I do still have a day job. So the YouTube stuff isn't my sort of primary income. So I do have a day job, and it sort of carried on for all these years. And last year I thought, should I ditch the day job? You know, can I make a go of YouTube?
And
at the moment I haven't. So I have still got the day job. I'm trying to do the YouTube thing and the day job. It's quite tricky because both are time consuming, obviously.
That's what I mean. The content and the quality of what you put out and the consistency of it, that's a serious commitment, because it is there. It's and like anything on YouTube, or if you're invested in someone like yourself, you're hungry for more, and you do feed the hunger. So that must take up a quite a bit of your time.
It really does, yeah, it does. I do work from home, so my sort of day job is a bit of a secret, and my employer doesn't know I do the YouTube stuff. So I've up till this point, it's probably a tipping point now. Your podcast.
This is the moment, John. This is the moment.
This is the moment.
So sorry.
I was going to say, at what point does your real job, the quality of that, start deteriorating because you're spending too much time on YouTube, and we don't want to expose you?
I couldn't possibly say.
You know,
I couldn't possibly say.
I was going to ask you something which I probably can't ask now. I was going to ask you then, would that be the dream then, to quit the day job and then to do this full time? But you better not answer that in case your boss is watching.
No, it would be the dream. It really would be the dream. And a couple of times I've thought of, it's almost been there. And then there were some redundancies at work, and I thought, if I could come out of it with a bit of money, you know, behind me as well, that would be ideal. But unfortunately, I wasn't included within that. I'm going to have a real trouble with this, aren't I? I'm close to it. But the trouble is YouTube's so up and down. So you can't. Yeah. And it was a case of putting all my eggs in one basket. Mm-hmm. The missus has got some sort of – missus is, doesn't work. She mm-hmm. has some anxiety and mental health problems. So she doesn't work. So I'm the only sort of income provider to the family. And just to sort of quit the day job and go, I'm going to be a YouTuber now. Mm-hmm. I'm not feeling brave enough. I don't feel brave enough. So, but let's see how it goes.
Yeah, I suppose to be honest, you're probably in the perfect situation. Then you've got your security of your regular job, if you like, and then your YouTube is just a hobby. And if it continues to grow, then hopefully one day you'll be in that situation where you might have to make a decision. But you know, long may it continue, because like Prat said, you're putting out content which people love to watch, and they want to see the next episode, up to next. So you know, considering you're doing this as a hobby, if you like, you're smashing it, mate.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. You always think, you know, if I had more time, to what could I do? You know, because that's the thing. At the moment, it's sort of ticking over and you think, well, I could maybe make a go of it, get another couple of decent sponsors on board. But you think, if I'm dedicating all my time to YouTube, now, what could it be? You know, and just sort of trying to set up, because obviously with work, I've only got a certain amount of holiday days as well. So I'm trying to fit everything in, like trips, launches, within my sort of 30 days holiday. I've actually pay extra to have a bit more, but you know, it's tough. And then of course the family want the holiday as well, so you've got to build all that into that as well. And I think if I could just sit and think, what am I going to do now, even just sort of setting up loans for bikes to be dropped off, picking all the logistics side of it takes time. You know, it takes time just to do all that stuff as well.
I mean, John, what you're saying there, I think it's fascinating, because there is a presumption that if you put things on YouTube, it's a very straight line, and it suddenly snap your fingers and your working world's moved into a different sphere. What I really love about what you said there is that balance and that juggling job that you do have, because like anything, it's like watching someone on telly. You watch someone on YouTube and you've got a picture of what their life is like and what they do and how they approach it. And you're probably the first person that we've spoken to that's really broadened that out in saying that to get from A to B, from what you watch, whether it's a garage build that you're doing, whether it's a bike review, there's a presumption that you just set up a GoPro and then you talk and that's it, done. But it's a hell of a lot of work, isn't it? Hell of a lot of work.
Yeah. I mean, I think even if you're recording so I go do a bike review, you know, I strap a couple of cameras on the bike, I go out for maybe an hour and a half, maybe sometimes an hour, you know, you do your bit, you do your recording, you get home. But that's really the easy bit. To be honest, you know, and then it's probably at least 8 hours to edit that video to a position where it's ready for YouTube, you know.
Yeah.
So it's all that behind the scenes stuff that I don't think people realize what goes into it, because you're always trying to better. I think with YouTube, you've got to evolve, because it's a changing platform. You know, the content people are doing is always changing as well. So you're constantly trying to evolve. You're constantly trying to be sort of innovative of what you're doing. So I tend to sort of try and set a lot of different cameras up on the bikes and get some interesting sort of shots as part of the reviews as well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's tough. It takes a while. It takes a while and all that. And then, of course, you've got to upload it, which takes bloody ages with my internet. And then you've got to settle your thumb there. You know, there's a lot of work. There's a lot of work to do.
It's quite refreshing to hear that honest appraisal of you from yourself of how hard social media is, because, you know, the whole thing about social media, it's not real, is it? You get the glossy finished product and everyone, wow, what a bike review. Look, the sun was out that day, but they don't realize the amount of hours that have gone into prepping that ride and then prepping the bike. And as you said, the editing skills. But what I was going to say was, you know, when you do a review on a bike, I mean, I'm sure, as we said earlier, you have to pinch yourself sometimes to think, you know, you're nearly making a full-time living out of something you love doing. But what is it like when you have to review a bike and it's probably not as praising as you might think? You've got to be honest, haven't you, and be authentic on your channel. But what's it like when you give a bike back, a loan back, and go, thanks for that, but maybe don't watch the upload next week? I mean, what's that like? How hard is it, to be honest?
I think as long as your criticism is sort of honest and you can back it up. So there's no point saying, oh, it's absolute rubbish, you know, I just don't like it. You know, you've got to give some sort of realistic feedback. And not everyone likes the same sort of bikes as well. That's the thing with bikes. There's so many different sorts of bikes. I haven't reviewed many retros because it's not something which I'm really got that passion for. But I have reviewed some and I'll sort of say, actually, I have really enjoyed this bike. You know, it may not be something I'm looking to buy myself, but you're just appraising it as a motorcycle. And I think as long as you're fair, and I'd say authenticity is key, because because a lot of people do criticize and say, oh, you like every bike you ride. Well, it's a motorbike. I do love bikes, you know. So yeah. even a bad bike, there's still some good and some good points you can point out about it. But there's not that many terrible bikes these days. You know, all the bikes now have had so much money spent and so much development that you don't really get the real old crap that you perhaps maybe did, you know. But I think as long as you can back up and say, look, because what I try and do is I'll review it and say all the good things. I'll say, look, niggles, what? Because there's only really niggles with modern bikes, and there's not a lot. You don't often ride something which is like, oh, that is just awful, you know. Mm. So it's all niggles. So I tend to point out some niggles, like it's a bit of vibration from the engine, or you know, finding neutral can be tricky. Because really, on modern bikes, that's all you really can criticise is little niggles like that. Because overall, you know, they're so good.
I think that's the lovely part about that is, John, and maybe as we're all. Becoming older gentlemen as the days progress, sense of what, going back to Ewan's point about what social media is and what it's built and fed with, is something's either absolutely awful or something's the best thing that's ever been done, seen, whatever. There is a huge space in the middle to do what you're doing, which is absolutely that. Yeah, this modern bike might not be to my taste, but I can absolutely appreciate what's gone into it, what it's good at. And it might be a sit up and beg. It might be one that I'm bent over. It's like you say, it's the little niggles, and it's why I'm more of a retro man, and I'd go towards retro looking bikes. But I can absolutely appreciate the beauty and the speed and the capabilities of a sports bike or a track bike. Absolutely. Yeah. It's not for one second that you think it's rubbish. So that sense of being able to deliver that in a balanced way, it's almost that side of it being, it feeds your demographic of people that have seemingly quite a balanced view of what motorcycling is and what motorcycles are. Does that then feed into these brands that come to you? And is that a case where now, because of your following, because of your videos, because of your platform, you get these people that build beautiful bikes, good bikes, high-end bikes, and say, look, Lamb Chop, do you want to come and review this? Here's a bike.
Yeah, you do get that for sure. I think you get quite an even sort of spread. So, you know, I do get contacted by all the manufacturers, you know, and say, you know, do you want to test this? Do you want to test that? I even get, you know, obviously like the electric sort of scooters. And I said, no, I'm not interested in those.
Yeah, they're terrible. Let's be honest. I mean, as much as I said, let's love them all, we're not having them.
Not those ones. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And it's, you know, sometimes it is a bit tough. What I like on my reviews, what I tend to do is not just, a lot of people will just read sort of specs of the bike, you know, it's 108 horsepower, it weighs this much. You can go on the website and find that information.
Read it down.
Exactly. What I try and do is see, what's it like to ride? Well, how does it make you feel? You know, what does it do? You know, how's the feedback through the bike? You know, what's the engine like between your legs? That's the stuff I try and bring through in my reviews, rather than just reading the specs. And it's available in orange and it's available in yellow, you know.
Thanks for that.
You've got the manufacturer's website to see that. You know, you come to my channel to find out what it's actually like to ride. And that's what I try and sort of convey in my reviews. But I don't think that answers your question, actually, does it?
No, but I think it's absolutely what it is about. You're so right. If you want to know, and do you know as well, when you read all that stuff on a website or in a magazine or online, and it's something that as a biker has bypassed me. I know how to ride a motorcycle. I know what I enjoy about riding a bike. But the minute someone talks about torque and brake horsepower, I just kind of, it depends where you are. You either nod along and go, yeah, or you just kind of go, do they know that I've got no idea what they mean by all of those? And I couldn't tell the difference between what bike had that brake horsepower. I could maybe in a feel of it and explain it in a different way. This feels like this. And then technically you might go, well, that's what that means. But that type of thing is never, because I've never understood it and never really appreciated what it is, completely goes over my head, mate. So when I'm watching you and you say how a bike feels, that speaks to me more than the spec sheet put out in an animated way, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. And I try and sort of, it's always tricky with YouTube, and it's getting worse and worse, sort of speed limits, people getting prosecuted from YouTube videos and stuff like that. But for me, a lot of things with bikes, and probably why I got into it, is that sensation of freedom and that sort of speed and performance. I am a bit of a speed junkie at heart, and I do love that.
on one of the earlier series, we had Chris Akabusi on, and his description of biking was unbelievable. It was all about the senses, the feel. And I love the fact you and Prats were just using the word feel, because it doesn't matter what you read about a bike, unless you've been out on it, it's so individual. It's brilliant. You mentioned you're a bit of a speed freak. I'm not surprised with your family heritage. Let's go back to the beginning. You said about your uncle was a successful bike racer. Your dad was into bikes. What was it like then when you took your bike test? First of all, did you feel the immense pressure? Like, I've got to pass my test. My uncle's going to rib me if I don't do it. And what was it like? Because I know for me and Prats, when you hear those words, congratulations, you've passed. I mean, it is just a weight off your shoulders. It's that freedom, isn't it? What was it like when you heard those words? Congratulations, you've passed this test.
I didn't pass the first time. So on the first test, I was like, I failed it. And I was obviously all your mates, how'd you get on? I failed it. I can't even remember how I failed. I think it was something ridiculous, like too cautious at a junction or something like that. And then when I rebooked, on the way to the test centre, my speedo cable broke on the bike. So I had no speedo. And I thought, when I got there, I was like, oh, do I tell the examiner I've got no speedo? Because he may say, sorry, you can't do it. Or do I just guess the speed limits? And that's what I did. So I guessed the speed limits. So when I'd finished it, I thought, I'm never going to pass. You know, I'm going to open a bit of speed. And he said, oh, congratulations, you passed. I was like, do I tell him now?
That's amazing.
But yeah, so I had to do the whole test with the added pressure of having no speedo and trying to sort of guess, is this about 30 down here? You know,
brilliant.
So, yeah, so I passed that. But that was
extra points for doing it that way, John, I would say.
Yeah, no, exactly. I can't remember. It was so long ago. We're talking back in ages ago. But I can't remember if I told him or not afterwards. I can't remember. But just when you've passed that feeling, though, and straight away, L plates, cut the L plates off the bike before you even get home. I'm taking the L plates off now. Yeah. You know, it's getting rid of those is the big thing, isn't it?
Is that word freedom the one that really hammers it home to you in your head and your heart with regards to what biking means to you, John?
Yeah, it's definitely freedom. And I think it's an escapism as well. You know, I find biking a really good escape. You know, if I'm got loaded down with work, and this is a little thing that worries me about obviously doing YouTube full time, is like, am I taking that passion and turning it into a job? Does it then become a job? And you know, I lose all of the enjoyment and the thrills of it. I mean, so, because when I go out, a lot of times you're like, well, let's put the camera on. And I'm like, well, no, not today. Let's just go out and ride without a camera. But you think, well, what if something happens and I miss it? But yeah, you've got to sort of separate the work from the fun riding. And I've got some really good mates. And you sort of go out on a Sunday morning with those mates and just have fun on the bikes. And like I say, it's that social thing, isn't it? Just stopping and chatting and talking about your latest upgrade or the new exhaust you've just put on your bike or whatever, you know. Yeah, love it.
Sounds like you've got a dog with you that wants to go on the bike, unless that's Pratt's dog.
It's my dog. I do apologise.
No, no, it's fine.
Mrs. may have a friend coming in a minute, so it may be getting even more barky. It's a little Jack Russell.
Any biking fans, even if they've got four legs, we're welcome. They're welcome on this channel. Don't worry about it.
And it feeds into that authenticity, as we said, chaps, doesn't it? Let's get a quick bit of mid-show housekeeping in. If you haven't already, please press subscribe on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from.
Right, John, we've got a deep dive into this now, because I think, by the sounds of it, you're going to have had a good collection of bike. Can we look through the history of your bikes then? Because I'm assuming it was a 50cc, then you got a 125, pass your test if you're like me. And then did you go and get something crazy straight away? What's your history look like?
I think back then, obviously, insurance isn't as bad as it is now, trying to insure bikes. But there was always that if you go too big, because there was no limit, of course, back then, if I remember.
No.
Once you'd gone for 125, you could potentially get whatever you wanted. But obviously the insurance was the cap, because you knew I couldn't afford to insure that. So I had the 125s and a few sort of DT dirt bikes, sort of sports bikes, 125s as well. I had a few of those. Like I say, I was in this sort of, lived on Hayling Island, which is where you know Hayling Island.
No,
but it was obviously quite a small town. So you knew everybody, you knew everyone who had a bike. And I remember buying this RD125 at the time, and it was all tuned, it had a full exhaust on it. And there was a lot of sort of bike swapping. And I had another mate who had a much newer bike, worth lots more money than this, but this thing was quick. And everyone wanted the fastest bike. So I ended up swapping the RD for a DT. So there's a lot of that went on. So I may have only had a bike a couple of weeks, and then someone said, oh, do you want to do a swap? You know, and I was sort of upgrading as you go. You know? But yeah, so I started on 125s, passed the test, and then got sort of 252 strokes, like a TZR 250, had a KR1 250. I had my uncle's old K1S race bike, because he ended up having this race bike. So I bought that off him as well. And then I had the biggest one I had in that sort of early years of biking was the ZXR 750, the H1, sort of that classic green, white, and blue paint scheme. I actually bought one to do a restoration on because I loved it, and one came up, and I thought, I'm going to buy one of those. And that was sort of the last big bike I had. And then I say the kids came, and then it was the Fireblade. What did I have after that? God, lots and lots. And then at one point I ended up took GSXRs, and I had a Ninja H2, which was sort of a dream, you know, poster bike, the supercharged H2, which I've done quite a lot of work to. And when did I get that? That was probably about 6 years ago. I had that now. But then sort of YouTube started, and it was quite good then, because then I could justify to the missus why I needed a new bike. So my mother said, how many bikes do you need? Well, you know, I've got the YouTube channel now. I've got to mix up the content, you know. Mm. So I've probably had 20, 25 bikes, I guess, over the time, yeah. And I fished through and did find out some old photos of the steeds I've had, which is quite nice. But
did you mentioned that gap that you had between life pre and post kids, and we've all been in that boat.
Yeah, yeah.
My word, that seems like a long time ago. was there, and coming back to biking, if you like, did you see a difference in the technology of the bikes, the ride of the bikes, even as well out and about on the roads? Did you feel a difference in the perception of bikers or the number of bikers?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, the bikes, obviously, the performance in that time had really stepped up. So when I say my ZXR 750 was probably about 100 horsepower, something like that, 110 horsepower. And then the Fireblade I bought was probably only 130, so it wasn't a massive difference. But the new bikes then were sort of pushing the 170s, 180 horsepower. So there was a big jump in performance. Also sort of the weight as well, you know.
Yeah.
The bikes I was riding were quite sort of heavy, and that weight had dropped. But I don't think I've sort of noticed much difference with the traffic on the road, because this was probably 2008, I suppose. I mean, it was starting to get busier, but not like it is now. You know, I mean, now it's seriously busy.
Carnage.
It's carnage, yeah. It's basically carnage. But yeah, not didn't notice too many differences, actually. No. Two phases there.
And would you have a favourite bike? I mean, it's akin to asking who your favourite kid is, I suppose. But in the ones that you've owned, and is the one that you've got a real soft spot for that you fondly remember and think, if gun to my head type territory, if I had to keep one, if I had to ride one forever, it'd be that one?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the CBR, that original Firebird I had that I did all of that work to, that was something I thought long and hard before sort of selling that. Because I only had a single, I've got a nice big double garage now, but I did have a little single garage, and just didn't have room to keep that and sort of the press bikes and the other bikes I wanted. But that bike is still around, so it's possible it may come back to me one day. I know who owns it now, so but that's probably
keeping close tabs on that.
I know he's got it, and I've sort of said, you know, if you ever want to get rid of it, you know, please sort of ask me first, you know.
Just tell the missus, that would make a lovely YouTube video, wouldn't it? Going back to one of your first loves, and I've got to buy it.
I did ride it again. I did do a video probably 5-6 years ago, and they said, do you want to ride it again? And I rode it again. And I actually thought, it's really uncomfortable. That actually put me off it a little bit. So it's probably why I haven't sort of made that move with him, you know. So I was like, well, actually, maybe I don't want this back. You know?
I suppose it's that analogy. Maybe that was how Ewan was going to frame it of this is going to get us all into trouble, of a former girlfriend where, she was lovely, and then, there's a reason why we broke up, and right, that's what it is.
Yeah, basically, that's exactly it. But I would love that one back. The other one I really regretted selling, I had a Gen 1 Super Duke, which had a lot done to it, carbon wheels, everything done to it. And I found it a little bit sort of lumpy in town, and it was sort of, got on my nerves a little bit. But I did some I did a tour through the Pyrenees on that with my mate Womble, and it was a fantastic, you know, it's all on YouTube as well. And sometimes I rewatch it and think, oh, no, that was good, you know, rewatch, because that's another reason why I started the whole channel, was just to log what you're doing and just to watch it back again and like
I
a
never
record.
Thought about it that way.
When I first started, that was a big reason for it, to sort of have it stored somewhere that you could revisit and rewatch. Yeah. And like I say, that Pyrenees trip is a prime example of that. Mm-hmm. And they did it on that bike. And I did really love it. And then I've actually bought a new Super Duke now. So I've actually bought the latest one. But that's really nice. Because I missed that. I missed that Gen 1, I think. It's one of those bikes. That was another one I really regret getting rid of. But you can't keep them all, right? You can't keep
Very
them
true.
All.
Very true.
Anyone with a mate called Womble is decent. I mean, that's I can ask just about Womble now. I can tell he's a decent guy just with that nickname. But honestly, John, in terms of the fortunate position you are in now through your hard work over the years, obviously, you know, you loaned all sorts of super bikes, whatever you want, you know, manufacturers will throw it in your direction. And you've clearly owned a lot of bikes. Is there one that eludes you though? Is there a bike that you think I've got to scratch that itch one day? Is there anything out there that you would love to own?
Yeah, there is. There's a couple of sort of retro bikes. One of the bikes my uncle had was an RD500, like the four pot two stroke based on like the GP replicas. He had one of those. And I remember going around his house one day and it went in his shed to get something, can't remember. And there it was in the shed with the lawnmower leaning up against it, just sort of neglected. And it's a big regret of mine that I didn't say that. Well, I couldn't afford it at the time, obviously I would have done. But if I didn't buy that off of him, because that was before, now they're worth like 20 grand, you know, they're unobtainable now. They're just too much money. But that was one I'd love to have a ride on. And there was the RG500, but I had a mate who did have one of those, and I did get to ride that and loved it. And the other one is like the RC30s, those sort of 80s classics, you know, really difficult to get on now because they were so much money. And probably the dream bike is the Honda RCV MotoGP bike in road trim. That is probably the dream machine. I would love to ride one of those, but you're talking to 200 grand-ish for one of those, you know. It's a proper, it's basically a MotoGP bike with a license plate on it, you know. I'd love to ride one of those, but I need to find a collector who's got all these bikes who wouldn't mind just getting a bit of exposure on YouTube. So yeah, if you're that person, then let me know.
Get in touch with Lambshop Rise. It seems, and because you mentioned the Cosworths as well before, and now cars is a thing that obviously very functional to me. You and Thomas has got a twin passion of motorcycles and cars, so you're very much on the same hymn sheet as him. But the look of that particular bike and of those bikes, and the look of that particular car, am I right in thinking there's kind of similarities in eras there, and in ways of kind of how there is not necessarily a straight line between them, but they're in the same type of ballpark on four wheels and two wheels. Is that where your kind of not necessarily cultural love, but the kind of fashion love of how a motorbike or a car should look, is that, are they boxed together in that era?
I guess they are. I think sort of growing up in the 80s, you're always going to look back with fond memories of the 80s. I don't know why. It just seemed that era seemed really cool. You know, it just seemed cool, didn't it? And those cars, you know, the Cosworths sort of built for, homologated for touring car racing, you know. So I've really got a passion for the bikes which were built for racing, but then they had to homologate them and, you know, release them on the road. Yeah. So bikes and cars. So I've always had a sort of love for, so again, it comes back to that sort of passion of speed, I suppose, and the thrill of it. Sort of, yeah, those sports machines, whether it's car or bike, just love them, really.
The love in your eyes is amazing. You can see it, and it's something that you and I can tell by his face, he's been drawn in even more. As much as we love bikes, he's drawn in even more when he hears about the car chat as well, don't you, mate?
It reminds me of my youth as well, you know, hot hatches, my TZR125 with the YPVS system on, you know, it's just going back to, it's evoking those memories, isn't it? You know, growing up, your first bike, your first car, you know, and it's just, I think some of these modern machines nowadays, be it four wheels, two wheels, with all the driver's aids and all that, it just makes it a bit too easy. And, you know, I think you go back to the word feel again, and it's feeling an old car, or it's feeling that bike, which is a little bit temperamental, you know. Yeah. You know, you love it. What I'd love to know, is there been a bike in the past that you've owned or ridden where it's kind of like, not frightened you so much, but have you sort of gone, wow, I mean, that's a little bit above my skill level? Or are you fortunate enough to be able to, because there's bikes out there that I wouldn't dare ride. You know, you've even mentioned old Fireblades. I've had R1s. I've had bikes where I've gone, this far out, where was my skill level? I'm in a straight line, I'm all right, but I'm giving this bike back. What bike has frightened you? Have you got off and gone, wow?
Yeah, the modern stuff can scare yourself to death, but because you've got the rider aids there, there's that safety net. And I think that, you know, that's there. You know, maybe you're giving it more credit than it's actually worth, that it could save you in a situation. But you know the bloke's got it, so you give it a bit more, and you know you've got ABS, you know you've got cornering ABS, and you know you've got these safety features behind you. But my KO1S I had, when that came out, they used to have a real reputation of tank slappers. So you'd hit a bump in the road and the bars would go lock to lock like this, you know, and you'd be out the seat. Well, I experienced it once on the one I had. And down on Hayling Island, there's a bumpy bit of road towards where the ferry is. And I was giving it a bit, I think it's only second, maybe third, and it just caught a bump in the road when the front goes all light, and it did this lock to lock. And I was literally, I was sat on the tank, you know, by the time it had finished, and I just about managed to stay on the bloody thing. But that was pretty terrifying, you know. You think, and there was sort of no reason for it. So at any moment, you'd be riding it thinking it could do that again, you know. So,
my word. Not so, yeah, a fan that, of that sort.
No, that was a bit sketchy. I'm trying to think of but the modern stuff, you know, again, it's all those safety aids and
Thankfully, yeah.
I mean, you know, that bike, there must have been people killed on that. Yeah. There must have been people being killed on the KO1S. They were so lively at the front end.
Do the bit that gives you the little shiver, doesn't it, when you're on a bike and you look outside and you see the wet leaves and you kind of think, those things that just keep you honest and in the moment and focused, and anything that a bike can give you to help with that has surely got to be a good thing. Yeah. Going back to what YouTube is, John, and the kind of space that you operate in, the content that you've got to put out, the consistency of what you need to put out as well. And you've mentioned and spoke about it with great detail and insight, the juggle that comes with being a family man and being a content creator and working as well. I mean, there's so many plates you've been in there. Mm. When it comes to planning out what's coming up, and what you want to cover and how far ahead you want to go, what's on the slate? What ideally would you like to do? What are the dream kind of content pieces you want to make, and what's coming up basically?
Yeah, it's a tough one. And I think because I have got the day job and I can't commit everything to YouTube, it's really hard to plan ahead too much because you're always reactive. And what we tend to find in this game is, you know, you may get an invitation to say, look, what are you doing next week? You know, we got this event on. Like, it's happened a couple of weeks ago. I had an invite. I was on a launch for Suzuki in Slovenia. They had a new Naked, a really nice little bike. And that same week, I had Ducati call me and say, look, what are you doing? What are you doing next week? You've been invited by Bologna to do a tour of Iceland on Desert X's for a week, you know, sort of. And I'd really hurt my back. I had terrible sciatic in my back. And I was like, and I also had this other commitment. I'd sort of promised to do this thing with Suzuki. And I said, oh, I'm really sorry. I can't do it. But it was like a dream. So I said, look, if you're doing it again next year, please let me know, because, you know, the Iceland on a bike. He said, oh, there'd be whale watching. There'd be volcanoes. And I'm like, can you shut
up? Stop telling me.
But that's the way it happens. So a lot of stuff is sort of last minute a little bit. Mm. Some stuff, you know, it is planned in ahead, or you'll be talking to someone and they go, oh, I sort of forgot about you. Well, you know, we've got this launch going on. We can squeeze you on it. Do you want to come along? But it's so hard to plan things like that when I've got the day job. You know, I'd like next year to do some sort of tour with Womble and another guy and do sort of a comparison video. Just basically an excuse to go off to Europe on your bikes and call it a YouTube video, but get people to give you the bikes to ride, you know, and maybe even get a bit of money in the bank for sort of sponsorship for the trip as well. So funding your motorcycle fun, basically.
It's a lovely position you're in for 2026, John, because it sounds to me like your diary is fully stacked, because A, you're good at what you do, and B, people realise that and they want to give you bikes. And, you know, it's lovely to be able to be in that fortunate position to turn work down. What I'd like to know, honestly, me and Prance could talk to you literally for the entire year, but we've got to get to the final question. And I think yours is going to be a bell to this one. We like to ask our guests about their fantasy ride. So, you know, what's your idyllic ride? Where would you be going? What bike would you be riding? I'm assuming Womble would be coming with you, but who would you be taking with you? And would there be any music you'd be listening to? So you've ridden so many lovely bikes. I can't wait to see what the bike of choice will be. What would be the road of choice? Who would be your riding partner? And what music would you listen to?
That's a great question. Well, there's two trips I'd really like to do. First one, sort of, I guess, is quite a common one. It would be sort of Route 66 through the States on a big Harley. Miss, I'll probably take the miss. I'd love to take the missus. I'm trying to get her into bikes. She's been on the back a little bit when we were younger, but I mean, convincing her, come on, just think we could hire a big Goldwing. We could ride down to Switzerland. You know, we could do all that, you know. So I'm trying to talk her into that. But Route 66, missus on the back, big Harley. It would probably be, in my head, it sounds fantastic, but it would probably be loads of straight roads, you know, no corners, but just the scenery, you know, everything about it. I'd love to do that on the Harley. And it would have to be, I don't know what the song's called, but, you know, Terminator 2, Bad to the
Bone. Oh,
when he pulls into that. I'd have that blaring out on there. They'd have to have a radio on the Harley.
I'd like the Terminator. Keep your clothes on for that one, though, yeah?
Yeah, that's right. Even your clothes, your boots, and your motorcycle. Yeah, that would be special. And I'd also, before I get too old, I really fancy sort of pushing myself. Because the best trips are the ones which there was some sort of calamity or it was physically hard. This is sometimes you look, yeah, a bit of a test. That Pyrenees trip was... We had to do 500 miles a day because we couldn't be away for too long. So we were turning up at like a hotel and 1 in the morning. It was almost a bit of an endurance event. And looking back on it, that sort of made the trip, really. The hardships sort of made the trip. So what I'd quite like to do is some sort of trip through sort of the mountains of India, sort of up that way on something, you know, something with a bit of off-road, a bit of challenge to it, a bit of risk to it. Mm-hmm. You know, you need to be a little bit fit, which I'd have to work on, but it'll be a goal, you know. I'd love to do that as well. I don't know what music I'll be listening to on that one, but...
Back to the Bone all the way through.
Back to the Bone, probably. Yeah, that as well, yeah. But yeah, that's two trips I would love to do at some point.
They sound absolutely amazing, John, and it's just been such a pleasure. Like I said, that kind of possible lazy stereotype about YouTubers that it's all very straightforward and it's just completely days filled with content, and it's real life tends to be put on the back burner, but real life is very much front and center of what you're doing right here and right now, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's a lot of people think it's all glam. You know, you go on these launch events, it's all glitz and glamour. You ride fantastic roads. You do, but there's also a lot of faffing. There's a lot of waiting about airports. You know, you're going away for perhaps 3 days. So you're flying out, you've got a day then, you're flying back again. That's grief, isn't it? Just doing that whole airport thing. Mm. And then when you're on the bike, they want to get all the photos, the videos. So you may ride it for an hour, and then it's like, right, all line up, one at a time, ride past the cameraman, you know. And it's all very much like that. So a lot of it, you know, these launch things, the bike's really good, but you actually haven't spent that much time riding the bike. You know, you'll be following somebody as well. So you won't, very rarely you'll let off the range just to go and do your own thing. So, you know, the actual what people expect happens on these things, and the reality, one day I might do a video of just all the rubbish which happens on a launch.
Should be behind the scenes,
queuing up for photographers, just waiting, sat in the baking sun, you know, and all your kit, just waiting to ride. Just do a video showing how rubbish it is.
Well, that goes back to what you said, doesn't it? It's about funding the fun. That's what we're all here for. Sadly, that's it for this week's Full Chat powered by Bikeshaw. It's UK's largest independent motorcycle cycle insurance broker. Bikeshaw will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your annual moped, scooter or bike insurance. And that dog is having a right good time, isn't he?
That's the missus's friend turned up just at the wrong moment.
Yeah, don't worry about it. It's just like this chat has been, John. It's been real and it's real life. And that's what we've loved about having you on. So thank you so much to our special guest this week. Absolutely brilliant. The one and only John Bennett, a.k.a. Lamb Chop Rides. You've been brilliant. Thank you, John.
Thank you so much. Loved it. Loved every minute. Cheers, guys.
For all you listeners out there, don't forget to press the subscribe button on YouTube. That's a watcher so that you never miss an episode. Or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from.
As ever, from Prats and myself, it's been an absolute joy. Thank you for joining us. Until next time.